This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Steve DeJarnett. Steve, great talking to you. Big fan of your work.
Thank you very much. Good to talk.
And I'm also here with Brandon Adamson.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Brandon.
So, Steve, you were posting on Facebook that you have a plan to put out a website to promote the film Miracle Mile.
Well, I've just, I put a lot of stuff on Facebook that I have from, I don't know how many boxes of stuff. And so, yeah, I want to get a dedicated website mainly for Miracle Mile, also a bunch of things for Cherry and some other, other films I've done, shorts and television and such. Hopefully we'll have it begun by the end of the year, which is the 30th anniversary of Miracle Mile.
A Miracle Mile was initially a screenplay that you wrote back in the 70s.
Well, technically, yeah, I pitched it in 1979, and I actually turned it into Warner Brothers, who would commission it from a pitch, I think December of 79, so I just at the very end of the 70s.
You later bought back the screenplay from the studio, and then they offered to buy it back?
Yeah, I've told the story before where, they liked it, they just wanted to put more writers on it. I was the director. I had made a short film noir, 35mm black and white, showcase short that got me into the business. And so I was sort of hot as a director, not really as a writer even. And so I had to, Warner Brothers wanted to do something with me. And they liked it, but they, they were going to mess with it. And I asked for it back, and they gave me a free year of turnaround. And then I optioned it for a year or two. And then I had to buy it outright, or somebody else was going to do it, and I was able to do that. So, and then I rewrote it, and yes, they offered me a fortune to sell it to not direct.
So. What in particular do they want to change? Was part of it the pessimistic, the dark ending?
Well, I found out later, and I didn't really know this at the time, that Mark Rosenberg, who was the head of production, who actually his brother Alan plays the young street sweeper in the movie, sort of playing a version of him because Mark was in the SDS and was a bit radical, that it was he had it in mind for it to be Twilight Zone the movie, not a four-part thing, but like just a standalone movie, which I don't think would have pleased Twilight Zone fans and wouldn't have worked for Miracle Mile either. And maybe the only thing they really wanted to change was at the end he woke up and it was all a dream and then it started happening again, which is, you can almost lop that ending off and still make the movie, but I said no. So I think there's a couple of names, maybe George Miller after Road Warrior, the second Mad Max movie, I said if he wanted to direct it I would take the bucks and go away, but that didn't work out.
I noticed both of your films, Cherry 2000 and Miracle Mile, they have a very distinct visual aesthetic. Was that intentional?
Well, yeah. It's not an accident. I would say Miracle Mile is much more what was intended. Cherry is more what we were able to get with 7 weeks prep and shooting all over toxic locations in Nevada with, sets that weren't built and other things. So it's what it is, and it's fun, but it's not, I look at Cherry and I go, it's like, that's not how it's supposed to be, but, still, I enjoy it now. It wasn't fun shooting particularly.
With the Miracle Mile film, how much of it was it mostly sets, or was it majority of it filmed actually in the Miracle Mile neighborhood?
We had one elevator set. It was about 4 feet across, 5 feet across. That was it. And no, we filmed on locations. We blocked off Wilshire. We, didn't have money to build sets. So it was a cheaper movie than Cherry.
Well, yeah, I've seen both of those films. They both had a profound effect on me as a kid. When I saw Cherry 2000, I was a kid. It was on HBO during the summer, like during the day. And I always enjoyed it. And I think that Cherry 2000 is actually, of the two films, was very prescient and very topical now, I think. So it's still relevant. Miracle Mile is kind of Cold War dated, but also Miracle Mile, when I saw that originally, I think it was in maybe the summer of 1990. It was on HBO at like 2 or 3 in the morning, and I remember
that's
just being like,
time for it, right?
Yeah, and I remember just being like completely disturbed by it, but I couldn't like stop watching it. You know, one of those kind of movies. And after it was over, I remember just being like really like disturbed by it, kind of like bummed out, but like in a good way, kind of like, yep, in a way that it like affected you. And
it's supposed to mess you up. That's what it should do. Yeah, Cherry, I think it only people watching it today, because HBO, for some reason, ran it all the time, and then people found it on there. So,
Yeah, that's how I found it. And I think that what always interested me about Cherry 2000 and why it's still kind of relevant, I think, is that because it was like for a guy who's romantic, that he would actually find more romantic fulfillment with like a sophisticated robot that could be programmed for those things, rather than how the real people have become kind of much colder and transactional in their...
Yeah, all the attorneys negotiating that's happening and you know, sex or domestic robots that can come close to the uncanny valley, you're just around the corner too. So
even things like Tinder, you know, everything's just, the dating is so much more transactional now, even if it's not necessarily monetary. And I think that Cherry 2000 is kind of it's almost like the opposite of the Stepford Wives, because in the Stepford Wives, like, the husbands just want like basically a dumb sexed up robot, and they're willing to discard their passionate wives or whatever. Whereas in Cherry 2000, like, he gets the, like, he's a romantic guy and he wants the robot.
Yeah,
for,
but
like,
the moral of the story by the end of the film is you give up that robot for a sweaty, difficult human,
right,
female, which some people say, no, give me the robot. But
which again is also kind of the opposite of how the Stepford Wives ends, you know, even though the moral is kind of similar.
Yeah,
but it was still ahead of its time, because all these issues, like, you're constantly reading articles about, like, sex robots, and were people discussing that back then?
No, because they weren't really, you know, there's blow-up dolls, perhaps. and now Vice, I know Vice Media has done pieces on both films, and, you know, I mean, there's a much more likelihood that we'll all get nuked, the entire world, tonight than back when I made the film, or even back during the Cold War, where we were on red alert and ready for it. The missiles are still pointed, and who's watching, who's hacking. I think it's much more likely we all die in that now, and I don't know why we haven't yet. But,
yeah, I also think that Miracle Mile is really one of the things that's so disturbing about it, I think, is how realistic it is in terms of people trying to survive in that brief period of time and just the chaos. And I also think what makes it a little bit creepy now is just that some of the fashions and the I mean, the lead female character with, like, that mullet, you know, that's, like, it's so dated, but it adds to, like, the disturbing factor of it.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before, too. People go, what would you want to change in your movie? And I go, I'd like to have a big CGI budget and replace the mullet. Otherwise, not that much. But yeah, that does date it, as some of the other style does. I have pointed out, I think we pointed out in the commentaries, my DP, Teo Vandesante, and Chris Horner, the production designer, because we're also talking about Johnny's, how Johnny's is exactly the way we art directed it and left it. It wasn't that way before, and it's still the way we left it.
Yeah, I noticed, that's a diner. I noticed that's changed because, like, I'm really...
Well, it's Bernie's now, sort of.
Oh, right.
But still,
like, I noticed...
But the interior with the colors of the interior, the blue and the orange, everything, we did that, and we changed all the lights, and it's still that way. Well, one thing, just on the thing of dated looks and stuff like that, one thing that makes it a little less dated is we didn't wet the streets, which every 80s film did, and we didn't use smoke and backlight, you know, going for the Blade Runner look, which you can't do on a low budget, but every MTV video of the 80s did that. And that makes films from the 80s look a lot more dated if you do that look. And so we just had sort of dry, you know, pristine, crystalline streets without a lot of, you know, smearing up the lens or using smoke and doing all that other stuff.
Yeah, well, some of that, like, has also, even though it's dated, a lot of that has kind of come back through the surreal, like, vaporwave aesthetics, and the whole, like, 80s workout kind of aesthetic has also kind of come back in a way and really become its own distinct thing.
I don't really know what you're talking about there. I mean, I know Stranger Days or whatever, you know, that's an 80s homage. And the 80s had a lot going for it. It, you know, a lot of silliness too, but, you know, the 90s are kind of blah, and most of this century has been undistinctive as far as, like, you know, an aesthetic, or, you know, it keeps reinventing old things rather than finding something new. I mean, there's some things.
Right. I think the closest you can get is maybe, like, the early 2000s, like the really bizarre, like, emo look, you know, the kind of teen, like, emo look, and, like, scene kids in that. I don't know. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Wait,
but if you look
know.
At, like,
I'm
old,
sure.
old MySpace, yeah. Profiles and stuff like that, they really have have developed a dating for a specific period of time. That's just me. You know, maybe I'm just, like, a generation younger or something, so I notice it. But, you know.
Well, there is a real, like, surreal quality to the film in regards to the visuals. And the music, the Tangerine Dream soundtrack really adds to that, but just the overall visuals, there's a real surreal quality.
Yeah, I mean, Tangerine Dream really, you know, pulls it all together. I wrote it to Tangerine Dream, so it was a big, huge thrill to be able to get them and go work with them over in Vienna, and, you know, that was fantastic.
Was there something about the area, Miracle Mile in particular, that interested you?
Well, the name, the deco buildings, and foremost the tar pits, you know, because it begins and ends there in a montage of meeting cute against extinction, and at the end of the movie we're all extinct. So it's, yeah, that was the bookend that was imperative. I don't know where else it could have played.
Well, what about like personally, was that like an area you hung out? I used to live in West Hollywood, so I'm somewhat familiar with that sort of thing. I was just curious if that, like, was related to some kind of diner you hung out with or something, you know?
No, actually, I went to other diners, and some of the original scripts and storyboards, it's set in sort of a supermarket, round kind of diner thing, all-night place further down the street, because we didn't think we could get Johnny's, I think. But I'm glad we switched it to that. You know, it used to be one of the most visited tourist places in Los Angeles, and now they're messing it up. I have a bad feeling about what they're going to do anytime the people who are going to redo the museum.
Oh yeah, I've seen the new renderings. Like, it looks pretty terrible. Like, they're going to completely ruin it. I mean, They should just leave it as
this.
There's
a lot of terrible ideas going on in our city that are just, you know, we're losing why we love Los Angeles, and they're trying to turn it into something else, and it's a crime in my opinion, but it's very tragic.
One thing I did notice about the portrayal of Miracle Mile is it has a very kind of gritty, very gritty urban feel to it, while the area today is more upscale. Was that just a product of how the area has changed, or did you intentionally go for that kind of grittiness?
No, it was big upscale in the 40s or whenever. It was the Beverly Hills of L.A., and then it fell to seed. So when we filmed, and you know, when I wrote it in the 80s when I was trying to get it made, it was run down. I had three offices down there. You could get like an office for nothing. It was seedy and dead at night, completely dead. That's why I liked it too. You really didn't see many cars.
Which scene was the most difficult to film?
Well, the blocking off the streets, you know, on a $3 million budget, you know, I still don't know how we did it. Shooting with a helicopter, actors getting on a helicopter, you know, just 7 weeks of night shooting, pretty much. That's difficult for anybody, anytime, to be on that schedule.
Has there ever been anyone looking to remake those films? I mean, I absolutely hate movie remakes, but you know, there's always some kind of
many people talk. And I'm actually hoping someone will, you know, want to do that officially. And there's been talk, particularly in the last few years, because they have to hire me as the first writer and the first director, so I'll get a payday and I can go back to the original draft, which was an older guy going back to get his ex. Sort of the grandparents' love story was the main story. And, you know, I'll pass the baton to somebody else and then they'll go wreck it. But, you know, I will start it off with, you know, solar flares taking down the cell communications, you know, intermittently for the month before the movie starts, and they're out that night. Because I don't want everybody to have a cell phone and be able to communicate. I don't want to conceptualize that movie. I want to, you know, make what works in there now work for today within reason. And, you know, and then if I have no control over it, they're going to do what they're going to do. But, and I hope it's good if it actually gets made. If not, then I will get a nice payday.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it would be really good for you financially, and it would also kind of help to elevate the original movies by drawing more attention to them. But, you know, they always talk about, like, how they want to remake Logan's Run. They've been talking about it for so long, and I'm just absolutely dreading it because, like, that's,
I mean,
like, one of my,
like,
favorite movies.
Remaking Total Recall or whatever. Nobody even saw it. I mean, they do these, and then they get some star that isn't really a star, and most of the public doesn't know who they are, and then they do just sort of a by the numbers, you know, it's one thing to take a concept and then do something new and exciting with really talented actors and writers and a director, but they just sort of hedge their bet and just remake it for the sake of remaking it, and there's no audience for it because people just want to watch the original. So.
Yeah, and they also will remake it or something with, like, focusing on improving the effects or something, but then they will always completely lose, like, the original meaning or whatever. When they remade Rollerball, that was another good example.
Oh, there's another one. Total Recall, Rollerball, Point Blank, not Point Break, Point Blank. Well, Point Break they shouldn't have remade either. It's like, there's a reason why we like certain movies with their flaws, including mine, and it's like, you know, there's very, I don't know. I mean, you know.
Yeah, how do you remake Point Blank without Lee Marvin? I mean, I don't think
it was
really
Mel Gibson, but, you know, and I hear there's a version of it that's better, the director's cut or something, but still, I'm sorry, you can't do that. And, you know, there are examples of, I mean, The Fly with Jeff Goldblum is a masterpiece.
Or The Thing is good. The Thing,
Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So there's an example of a great, you know, director with, you know, and with physical effects in both of those, not CGI. The Thing and The Fly, and in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, three great directors remaking a movie that's that's as good as, you know, or better than the original. And today, yeah, they just, the CGI, just, I just yawn with all the CGI. It's just, anything can happen, impossible, you know, outrunning explosions, and they're always threading the eye of the needle and when a building's falling, and it's just, you just yawn, because there's no jeopardy. It's just, anything can right. happen, so it's, nothing is worth watching, really.
We're getting close to the end of this show. Steve, is there anything else you'd like to add about any of your films?
You know, go find the Kino Lorber Blu-ray or DVD, but Cherry's also with Kino Lorber, I think only Blu-ray. Don't watch it on Amazon yet or Netflix until they have the good version. It's the old, horrible-looking version that's... it's not panned and scanned, really, but it's in the wrong format, and it's all blown out and looks terrible. There are French, German, and Arrow in the UK versions that are better, and that they have my short films on it and some other stuff. And, you know, find me on Facebook. I'm sort of filled up, but I keep deleting people that I have no contact with. And there will be a website, and there'll be lots of goodies on there. And there's lots of good extras on the Blu-rays, too.
Steve DeJarnett, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Good luck.
And also, thank you, Brandon Adamson.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. It was great talking to you, Steve.
Okay. Bye-bye.